Great. So thank you very much for inviting me to be here today, and thanks a lot for coming to the talk. So today I want to talk to about these logarithmic Sobolev inequalities for quantum mechanical systems. Yes, it's on. Yes, thank you. I want to talk about these logarithmic Sobolev inequalities, which are the main topic of my thesis, which I'm currently finishing. And I'm going to talk about several different results that have come out in the last years in collaboration with some of these people that I mentioned here. So Ivan Bagde and Cambi Suse, and the other two, Angelo Lucci and David Perez Garcia, are my supervisors. So, well, I mentioned here that this talk is going to be based on these four papers. Of course, I'm not going to talk about the whole four papers, but it's just because we have, during my thesis and during all these years, we have developed kind of a strategy to prove these logarithmic Sobolev inequalities, well, you will see now, assuming several conditions and so on. And some of the results that I'm going to mention today are contained in some of these papers. So first of all, well, just to, sorry, just to give some context to the talk, well, we are working on something that lies in between quantum information theory and quantum many-body physics. So you know that there are strong connections between these two fields, and the problems that appear in their intersection are numerous. So for example, some tools from, I mean, some communication channels in quantum information theory can be seen as physical interactions in quantum many-body physics. And for example, tools and ideas from quantum information theory can be used to solve problems for in quantum many-body physics, and the other way around. Some models from quantum many-body physics have been used to develop models of storage of and transmission of information in quantum information theory. So there are many interesting things in between these two fields. And the topic I'm going to talk today is also in between these two fields. So in particular, we're going to talk about dissipative evolutions of quantum many-body systems, which I'm going to explain in more detail later. And more specifically, we're going to focus on the speed of convergence of certain dissipative evolutions to their thermal equilibriums. And even if we want to focus a bit more and maybe define a more concrete problem, we're going to try to provide some sufficient static conditions on a certain Gibbs state, which imply the existence of a positive log Sobolev constant. And now I will explain what all of this means. So this was just to give some context. And now, well, we will start by talking about about these quantum dissipative systems, what they are, and some of their main properties. After that, we will talk about some results of quasi-factorization of the relative entropy, which I will explain later what they are. And we will use these results later to prove the existence of certain log Sobolev constants. So let's first go to quantum dissipative systems. Well, we know, I mean, the interest of these quantum dissipative systems lies in the fact that no experiment can be completely shielded from noise, neither executed at zero temperature. So we have to consider open quantum many-body systems, which are essentially systems that are contained in an environment with which they are weakly coupled. So this is what I mean by this arrow. And when we have this situation, the dynamics of the system contained in this environment is dissipative, so it tends to dissipate the initial energy. And we will see now that the continuous time evolution of a state of an initial state on this system is given by a quantum Markov semigroup. And this is what is called the Markovian approximation. We will explain now what this is. So just to introduce some notation, when we have a quantum spin lattice system like this, we will always consider finite lattices, which we are denoting by lambda. To every side of this lattice, we will associate a finite dimensional Hilbert space, Hx. We're going to assume for simplicity that all of them have the same dimension. And the global Hilbert space associated to the whole lattice is going to be the tensor product everywhere of all the local Hilbert spaces. And just to state the notation that we are going to use, we are going to denote by B lambda the set of bounded linear endomorphisms in H lambda, and the set of density matrices just by S lambda here. So the idea now to explain these dissipative evolutions is first that if you consider an isolated system, you know that the physical evolution of an initial state rho is given by U rho U star, where U is a unitary, and in particular, this evolution is reversible. But when we consider a dissipative quantum system, we are considering non-reversible evolutions, So we know that this should be described by a map T that takes rho to T of rho, and it should satisfy certain properties. So first, it should map states to states. So in particular, this implies that this map should be linear, positive, and trace preserving. And also, if you consider the tensor product of rho and another state which which has trivial evolution under T, and then if you consider this T hat that leaves rho, that leaves sigma invariant, then essentially what you are doing is consider your map T tensor with identity, and this should also map rho to a positive state. Map rho tensor sigma to a positive state. So this implies that T tensor identity should be positive for any dimension of the identity, and therefore it should be completely positive. And if you put all of it together, this means that T should be a quantum channel. And well, this means that a dissipative quantum system has to be described by a quantum channel. And you can also see that with another explanation, for example, which is that, of course, the system is not an isolated system because we are saying that it's now contained in an environment with which it is weakly coupled. But if you consider the whole system that is composed by the system plus the environment, then this is an isolated system. This is a closed system. So then, if we consider that the state from the environment is a pure state of this kind, taking rho to the tensor product with the state of the environment, and then considering, since it's as isolated, you can consider the evolution by means of a unitary U, and then trace out the effect of the environment, then if you consider all these maps and the composition of all of them, I mean, all of them separately are quantum channels, so the composition of all of them is a quantum channel, and thus this means that the composition of all of them, I mean, the map that we were defining at the beginning should be a quantum channel. So this is a way to see that the evolution of an open system at every instant t should be a quantum channel, but we are not describing the whole continuous time evolution. This is something that we have to do now. So as I'm saying, the time slice for every time is a realizable evolution, so it's a quantum channel. But now when we want to consider the whole continuous time evolution, we need to consider how the environment affects the system. And now, for simplicity, we need to make some assumptions. So the first one that we make is that the effect of the environment on the system, even if it's still important, is almost irrelevant. And by this, what we mean is that, for example, that the environment does not evolve. So for example, if you assume that you have a system in a very big thermal bath, heat bath, in principle, when the system is changing its energy, the thermal bath is not going to increase its temperature too much. So you can assume that the environment does not evolve with time, and this is what is called the weak coupling limit. And we not only assume this, but assume something that is a bit further, which is that the environment holds no memory, and therefore the future evolution only depends on the present, not on the past. And this is what is called the Markovian approximation. So putting all of this together, what we have is that a dissipative quantum system is a one-parameter continuous semigroup. This parameter is the time. And the semigroup is composed of maps, which are quantum channels, because of what we said before. And since it's a semigroup, it satisfies these two properties. So if you consider it at time t and at time s, and you compose it, you get the channel at time t plus s. And if you consider it at the first instant, you get back the unitary. And with all these properties, since we are only considering finite dimensional systems, we have the property that the semigroup satisfies the Liouville's equation, which means that if you differentiate with respect to t, every channel at instant t, you get this expression here for a certain operator L, which is the generator of the semigroup. This comes from this Liouville's equation. And this is why this infinitesimal generator is called Liouvillean. But also because of the assumptions that you are imposing on the semigroup, it satisfies Lindblad's equation, and this is also why it's called Lindbladian. And the whole point of this, of satisfying Liouville's equation and being able to integrate, is that you can get back this expression here, which means that if you want to obtain the evolution at every instant t, so the channel at every instant t, you can obtain it as the exponential of the generator and the instant t. So that's quite useful to understand the physical system. And now we have to further, for our purposes, we have to further impose a couple of conditions just to continue simplifying the system. So one system of this kind is always going to have at least one fixed point. So it's a consequence of Brouwer's fixed point theorem. But you can further assume that it only has one fixed point, and also it doesn't have periodic points because of simplicity. This is much easier. When you do that, you have the guarantee that it's going to converge to this fixed point when t tends to infinity, independently of the initial state. And by this I mean that if you consider any initial state rho lambda and you let it evolve with time t, after this time t, if you denote by rho sub t the channel at time t applied to this initial state, you get the expression that I write there. And when you, as I was saying, when you let time tend to infinity, this always converges to sigma lambda. And this is quite useful because now, okay, you know that you always have convergence. You don't know, for example, how fast this convergence is. And this is quite interesting. So this is something that I'm going to mention now, but before, since we have introduced dissipative quantum evolutions, let's think a bit why these quantum dissipative evolutions are useful. So there are many reasons, of course, but for example, one that is interesting for us is that many kinds of noise that can appear when you try to construct a quantum computer, for example, can be modeled by using these quantum dissipative evolutions. So understanding them is interesting it's important to try to overcome the issue that you can find of with the appearance of these kind of noises. And another one is more related to quantum dissipative engineering. So there was a recent change of perspective in this direction. So some years ago, some people started studying it as a resource to exploit instead of some issue that you have to overcome. And this is why this area appeared, this quantum dissipative engineering, with which they want to implement lifetime quantum memories. And by this, they want to create artificial evolutions in which this dissipative process works in favor instead of against us. So for example, protecting the system from noisy evolutions. And there are many interesting problems in this field. So for example, one of them is the computational power of these models. Another one is which conditions you have to impose so that you can protect your system against noise. And another one is, for example, the time that you have to wait to obtain certain states, which is the part that we are interested in. So related to this time that we have to wait to obtain certain states, you can define something that is called the mixing time of the semigroup or the generator, because they are related directly. And essentially, this mixing time of the semigroup is defined as the time that it takes for every initial state to become almost indistinguishable from the fixed point, more or less. So the idea is that for every epsilon, the mixing time of epsilon is the first instant, the minimum instant, for which every initial evolution is already contained now, after the evolution after time t, is already contained in a ball of center, the fixed point, and radius epsilon. And because here, when I'm writing t star infinity of rho, I'm writing the fixed point of the evolution, because as I said, all of them converge to this fixed point. And now we are interested in particular in something that is called rapid mixing, which is essentially that this mixing time scales properly in some sense. And this properly means that it scales polynomially with the system size, as I write there, and it decays exponentially with time. And these systems are interesting for many reasons. For example, because they are stable against local perturbations, and also because they satisfy AEA laws and these kind of things. So this is why providing examples of systems for which there exists rapid mixing is a very interesting problem. And of course, if you see the expression for rapid mixing, if you see this supremum, in principle, it seems quite difficult to obtain like a general condition so that you can prove that this supremum is bounded in this form, because you're taking a supremum over all possible initial states, so it doesn't seem easy. So it would be more interesting to get some general condition, for example, on sigma, so that you could imply that you have rapid mixing or something like that. And this is more or less what we try to do. So if you go to classical spin systems, there are some connections between different things. So these arrows that I write here are not equivalences, but this just means that there are results in some of these directions. So if you go to classical spin systems, you can relate the existence of some kind of optimal constants for certain functional inequalities, which are, for example, the Log-Sobrev constant and the spectral wrap. Also, you can relate it to this rapid mixing property that I said, and to some exponential decay of correlations on the fixed point of the evolution in that case. And in the quantum, for quantum spin systems, some people have tried to do something similar in the last years, and the connections are not so well understood as for classical spin systems, but there are some connections that I write here, which are a bit weird. So
can you go back to 1 slide? So here is gamma. It doesn't depend on the size, right?
No. Gamma is a universal constant. No.
Okay.
It shouldn't depend on the size. Exactly. Thanks.
One more question here.
Yes.
I may have missed it. Like, are there conditions that we need to make sure that there is a limit to the state? Tau star infinity acting on rho?
Yeah, I mean, this is always sigma. So because we are assuming that it always that you only have a fixed point, one fixed point, and you have guaranteed that it always converges to this fixed point,
okay,
with infinite time. So this is sigma. What I'm writing above and below are the same. I just wanted to write it, one of them with the channels and the other one with the states here directly. But they are the same expressions. So here you're assuming what I said before, just that you have only one fixed point and no periodic points and these kind of things. But the convergence comes for
random. Just a deep question. So if we consider a system with infinite size, then what is this kind of convergence? Is it strong convergence or weak convergence? Or is that not convergence?
It's a bit different. Yeah, it's not so easy to have
guaranteed. Is it still weak convergence?
In principle, you don't have that guarantee. You have to study
even,
differently.
Even you cannot do weak convergence.
I mean, what we are studying here, even
the star.
What, sorry?
I mean, is it possible to have some weaker convergence, like weak star or something?
I'm not sure about that. I know that you have to be more careful from the beginning, because, for example, you don't have here, you cannot go in both directions so easily. So you have a generator, but the generator you cannot obtain every channel from the generator in this form. It depends on more conditions that you have to impose. So when you're in infinite dimensions, you have to be more careful with this. So I'm not so sure that you have, that you can translate the same theorems directly to have the convergence guaranteed and these kind of things. But I don't know much about that, so. Yeah, so I mean, I was talking then about the connections of quantum spin systems. Of course, I'm not going to go into details in this diagram. This is just to mention that there are some functional inequalities that have been introduced for quantum spin systems, and there are some connections already introduced between them. And we only care here about this one. So this MLSI here for quantum systems is what for classical spin systems is called the Log-Sobolev constant. This PI, which is a Poincaré inequality, the optimal constant for it is the spectral gap for classical spin systems. So what I'm saying is that for quantum spin systems, at least we already know that Log-Sobolev constant implies spectral gap. And this is important. I mean, I just want to highlight this because this will be important later.
What's the name exactly? That if there's a Log-Sobolev constant, then the gap is positive.
Exactly. If the Log-Sobolev constant is positive, the spectral gap is positive. I mean, this is just important for us for one reason, because we are trying to find examples of positive Log-Sobolev constants, so we are already looking for them in systems for which we know that spectral gap is positive. It's essentially for that. I'm going to show now why we focus on these Log-Sobolev inequalities, because I said before that we want to provide systems or examples for which we know that there's rapid mixing. So what I'm going to show is that this Log-Sobolev constant implies that there is rapid mixing. So if you go back to Liouville's equation, the one that I mentioned before, that if you differentiate the channel at time t with respect to time, you get back the generator applied to this channel. So if you apply it to every initial state, you get this equation that I write here. And now if you consider the relative entropy of rho after time t and the fixed point of the evolution, now you can differentiate it with respect to time. And because of Liouville's equation, you get the expression that I write here. And the point is that now you have a, if you consider this as a function of time, you have a real function which has only one parameter, one continuous parameter. And you know that rho sub t is converging to sigma lambda. So you know that the relative entropy between rho t and sigma lambda is decreasing. Okay? So you have a function, a real function, which is decreasing, sorry, and for which the absolute value of the derivative is also decreasing. So in principle, what you can try to do is find an upper bound for the relative entropy between rho sub t and sigma lambda in terms of the negative of the derivative of this relative entropy between these two things. And this is something quite standard that you do when you try to, when you want to get a, sorry, when you want to get exponential rates on some quantity. So this is something quite standard to try to bound the one real function in terms of minus this derivative. Because now if you can find a universal constant that you can put here so that this holds for every initial state and for every t, you get some exponential decay, at least in this case for the relative entropy. And this is what you do when you want to define functional inequalities. So when you want to define the Poincaré inequality, you do this for the variance. And when you want to define the Log-Sobolev constant, well, Log-Sobolev inequality, you do it for the relative entropy. So now, if you can find here a universal constant so that this is always true, this constant is what is called the Log-Sobolev constant. So it's defined essentially as the quotient between the what I was writing as the right-hand side and what I was writing as the left-hand side, and taking the infimum over all possible initial state. Okay? And if you define this Log-Sobolev constant in this way, then you can go back to this inequality, to this inequation, and you can integrate it. And when you integrate it, you obtain the expression that I write here. So you obtain that the relative entropy at every instant t is upper bounded by certain initial quantity, certain initial relative entropy between rho and sigma, and some exponential decay with time, where the rate that you are putting there is exactly the Log-Sobolev constant. And the point now is that if you put this together with Pinsker's inequality, you get back the expression that I'm writing here at the left-hand side. And now, if you want to see how big this relative entropy can get, it takes its greater value when rho is the projector onto the minimal eigenvalue of sigma. And at this point, it takes the value of the logarithm of 1 over sigma mean, where this sigma mean is the minimal eigenvalue of sigma. So this essentially says, if you remember the expression for rapid mixing, you had the supremum over these differences, this one norm of the difference between rho t and sigma lambda for every initial state rho sub lambda. And if you go back to the expression that we just got, if you take the supremum here, you obtain exactly one condition that might imply rapid mixing. Why? Because you have there the exponential decay with time, with the rate which is the Log-Sobolev constant. And you have in front of, I mean, you have just before it, one expression that might scale polynomially with the system size. Because you know that sigma mean, not always, but it might scale polynomially. I mean, sorry, sigma mean might scale exponentially with the system size. So all the expression that you get there might scale polynomially with the system size. And the thing is that if you, instead of doing all of this for the relative entropy, if you start doing it for the variance and differentiate and obtain the Poincaré inequality and so on, and if you do this, you obtain a similar rate for the spectral gap. But the problem is that now you don't have a logarithm. So this is why having a Log-Sobolev constant is kind of exponentially better with respect to the system size than having a spectral gap. And at least we can have some conditions, we can impose some conditions on sigma for which this implies rapid mixing. So the problem that we had before of finding examples of rapid mixing has turned out to be finding positive Log-Sobolev constants. And this is why we're interested in finding positive Lovsovel constants, because they might imply examples of rapid mixing. So the main problem that we are going to talk about in the last minutes are how to develop a strategy to find positive Lovsovel constants. And after that, we are going to provide certain specific sufficient conditions on the Gibbs state, which is going to be this sigma that I have been talking about all the time, so that they imply the existence of a positive Lovsovel constant. So for that, to provide this strategy, what we do is go again back to classical spin systems and see how they did there. So for classical spin systems, there exists a strategy to prove Lovsovel constants, which is based on 3 points. The first one of them is something that they call quasi-factorization of the entropy, that I will mention later. After that, they have some recursive geometric argument, where they reduce the global Lovsovel constant to some Lovsovel constant in a smaller region. And after that, imposing some conditions, some decay of correlations on the Gibbs measure, in this case, which is the fixed point of the evolution, putting the three of them together, they obtain that there's some positive Lovsovel constant. And now, if we go to quantum spin systems, we need to do something similar. But the problem here is that when, in the second point, when they reduce from the global Lovsovel constant to a smaller sized region, a Lovsovel constant, they are using strongly some conditions that are called DLR conditions, which essentially say that when you condition what happens outside, I mean, what happens in a big region to a smaller region for classical spin systems, the effect of what happens outside this smaller region disappears. And this doesn't happen in the quantum case. So to try to translate this classical strategy to a quantum strategy, we need to be careful with this situation. And this is why we have to introduce something that we call conditional Lovsovel constant, which is going to be a bit different for every different example. So the thing that you had above was the Lovsovel constant that I introduced before. And essentially, the conditional Lovsovel constant in a smaller region A, if you compare the two definitions, the main differences are essentially that here you are considering the generator only in one smaller region, in this smaller region A. And here, there appears some term that is not known in principle. It's something that we call conditional relative entropy, but it's something that we also have to define. So once you have the idea of this conditional Lovsovel constant of mind, which is, as I said, is going to be introduced specifically for every dynamics, you can develop this strategy using this puzzle, which is what we did. So the first thing that we have to do, the first step of this strategy, is to provide a proper definition of conditional Lovsovel constant. After that, you have to provide a proper definition of the decay of correlations that you're going to assume on the Gibbs state. And once you have these two definitions, there are three things that you have to prove. So these are not definitions, they are proof. The first one of them is the analog of the quasi-factorization of the entropy that they had for classical spin systems. So in this case, it would be a quasi-factorization of the relative entropy, which is a bit different, and also in terms of this conditional relative entropy. So this is also something that you have to introduce. And after some geometric recursive argument, which is similar to the one that I mentioned for classical spin systems, you have to prove that the conditional Lovsovel constant to which you have reduced the global Lovsovel constant is positive. This is something that for classical spin systems you didn't have to do because you directly obtained it because of the way that is defined. But for quantum spin systems, it's a bit different. You have to be very careful. And actually, this is the most difficult part of the strategy in all the dynamics that we have tried. So this is essentially what I'm going to talk from now on about these 5 points.
So does this mean like you have to do all of these for like each particular example?
Yeah. Yeah, so this is essentially what we've done. We've spent much time on the quasi-factorization part because I think it's probably the part that gives you more space to play with. And then we have joined. I mean, we have ensembled all the pieces to obtain examples of positive Lovsovel constants for different dynamics. But yes, for every dynamics, it would be something different. So I'm going to move now to the part of quasi-factorization of the relative entropy. And I'm going to be a bit fast because I would like to show you how these pieces appear in the different dynamics, so I won't spend much time here. Let's just mention that this result of quasi-factorization of the relative entropy should be something like this inequality here. And the idea is that if you have a tripartite system in this way, so you have ABC and you consider AB in one part and BC in the other part, one should be able to prove an inequality that upper bounds the relative entropy of two states in the global system by means of the sum of two things that are these two conditional relative entropies in AB in one part and BC in the other part, and some error term here that measures some interesting property on the second state, on sigma. And this interesting property is the one that should be related to some decay of correlations on sigma, in some sense. And the idea is that if you compare it to the classical case, I'm not going to go into detail here, in the classical case, they have some entropy here of a function and some conditional entropies in the right-hand side. And the term, the multiplicative term that appears there, measures how far these two subalgebras F1 and F2 are to be independent from the measure that you're considering there from mu. So in our case, I mean, and this conditional entropy is what I'm writing below, so I don't want to go into detail here, but the idea is that we're going to do something analogous for the quantum case. And for that, the first thing that we have to do is define this conditional relative entropy that we are writing there above. So for that, if we go back to the definition of quantum relative entropy, it has many interesting properties, but here we focus on these four properties. If you consider the relative entropy in bipartite systems, you know that it's continuous with respect to the first parameter, it's additive with respect to tensor products, it's super additive with respect to a tensor product only in the second term, and it satisfies a data processing inequality for every quantum channel that you apply. And the point is that we focus on these four properties because they characterize the relative entropy. So when you have a function on pairs of states satisfying these four properties, it's the relative entropy. And we try to do something similar for this conditional relative entropy. So what we do is think the kind of properties we would like it to satisfy. And after we impose these properties, we find that there's a unique form for this conditional relative entropy. So essentially, the properties that we would like a conditional relative entropy in A to satisfy are that, I mean, since it should extend the definition of the conditional entropy for when the states are classical, and also when A is the whole system, it should also extend the relative entropy, some of these properties are quite natural. So I mean, just to give an intuition, the idea that we have for this conditional relative entropy in A should be that it should somehow provide the distinguishability of two states in the global system, conditioned to the fact that you know their distinguishability in the complement of A. So in this case, it would be B. Because of that, it should satisfy some properties. So first of all, the continuity with respect to the first parameter, because it has to extend the relative entropy. Second, the non-negativity, because it extends the classical conditional entropy. And the condition that I write there as 2.1 is some recoverability condition that we need to assume for our purposes. This is just something that we need to assume in our case. I think it's quite reasonable. It's essentially that it vanishes if and only if it can be recovered by means of the best recovery math for the partial trace. And the properties of semi-superadditivity and semi-additivity that I write here essentially say that if you consider the conditional relative entropy in A and B and you put them together, then you have the property of superadditivity and the property of additivity, which is something reasonable. And the property of semi-monotonicity that I write here, what it says is that if you consider a quantum channel with support in B, for example, it's not reasonable that it should satisfy a data processing, that this quantity with respect to that channel should satisfy a data processing inequality. Because somehow, every time that you consider a quantum channel, you should add the effect that it has in the B part, which is what you write here in the second part. And then when you add this effect in the B part, then it should satisfy a data processing inequality. So this is what we are writing here. And when we put all these conditions together, we get the axiomatic characterization that I write here, which is that the only possible expression for this conditional relative entropy is the difference between the global relative entropy and the relative entropy in the complement, which is something kind of reasonable, I would say. And for this definition, I mean, of course, you could look for this definition with different purposes, but for our purposes, we want to prove results of quasi factorization, so we should be able to prove results of quasi factorization, because if not, we should look for another definition. So the question now is, can we prove one inequality of this kind with this definition? And the answer is yes. So when you have tripartite systems as the ones that I was mentioning before, like considering A, B in one part and B, B, C in the other part, you can prove this inequality here. When the error term that appears here is quite similar to the one that appeared for the classical case and measures how far sigma is from being a tensor product between A and C. So it's measuring the same thing that for the classical case, which was how far these two subalgebras were to be independent from under the measure that you were considering. So you can see that if sigma is a tensor product between A and C, then you get there a one, so the quasi-factorization is quite well. And the good thing is of this expression is also that if you rewrite the expressions of the two conditional relative entropies and play a bit with them, you get back the expression that I write here. So this expression is equivalent to the one that I was showing before. And this is something that is in between, this is something that extends superadditivity, the property of superadditivity in the following sense. So the property of superadditivity said that if you consider a tensor product in the second input, you always get a lower bound of the relative entropy between these two states in terms of the sum of the two of them. But the constant that you have here in front of the relative entropy of the two states is one. And if you consider the property of monotonicity for every quantum channel T, which says what I'm writing there, if you consider it for the partial tracing A before and for the partial tracing B later, and you sum of both of them, what you get is that twice the relative entropy between rho AB and sigma AB is the lower bounded by the sum of these two. So if you put both of them together, you can see that the expression that we get above is something in between when the norm of H is small enough, because it gives you something that is a bit tighter than the expression that appears here. And also only when, as I'm saying, only when this infinity norm is smaller than 1/2. And it's also giving you some measure of how far this sigma AB is from being a tensor product. So it gives you an inequality for every sigma.
Sorry, what is H?
Sorry. What is
this capital H?
It's the thing that appeared here, sorry. The thing that appeared here below. So it's one way to measure how far sigma is a tensor, how far sigma is from being a tensor product between A and C in this expression and A and B in the other expression. So this is why I say that it's not only valid for every possible sigma, but it's also giving you how far this sigma is from being a tensor product.
So if sigma A is just a sigma A times sigma B, it's zero.
It's one, exactly. You get back the expression of superadditivity, exactly. And it's nice in that sense. And also, well, I will skip this, but the idea is that these definitions that we have introduced also extend the classical definitions. So this is something more or less safe. And yes, I will mention the examples briefly, the examples that we have studied for this Lok-Sobolev constant, and how we have ensembled the pieces that I was mentioning before for these examples. So the first example, which is probably the most interesting one, and also the easiest one, is the heat bath dynamics with a fixed point, which is a tensor product everywhere. So this heat bath dynamics is something that is given at every side. The generator is defined as the difference between this channel E star X and the identity. And this channel E star X is just the Petz recovery map for the partial tracing X with respect to sigma. And since we are assuming that sigma is a tensor product everywhere, when you apply this channel to rho lambda, it's just essentially sigma X tensor rho X complement. So the idea is that at every site, you trace out your state, you trace out the site X, you reconstruct it with sigma, and then you see how far this is from the original state rho lambda, and you do that, overall possible site, and you sum all these effects. You see how far they are from the initial state rho lambda. And for these dynamics, you can study all these five pieces separately. After putting all of them together, you can get that you have a positive Lok-Sobolev constant, which is actually 1/2. So this is what we want to study, these 5 points. The first one of them is quite easy, because this decay of correlations of the Gibbs state now is too simple. It's not that one decay of correlations per se. It's just to say that the Gibbs state is a tensor product of single side states. So it's much easier in this case. The second one, which is the definition of the conditional Lhov-Sobolev constant, is just that for every side x, we consider the definition that I was mentioning before, so the infimum between these two quantities, and the thing that appears in the denominator, this conditional relative entropy is the conditional relative entropy that I mentioned before. So once you have these two definitions, you can go to the three results that you have to prove. The first one of them is the quasi-factorization of the relative entropy. And now for sigma a tensor product, you get a much nicer result than the one that I was showing before, because here you can see that there's no multiplicative error term. That before we only got, in the right-hand side, we got the sum of two terms. Here we have the sum of many more terms. And also we don't have a multiplicative error term, because this multiplicative error term should measure how far sigma is from being a tensor product, and it's already a tensor product. So this is why it doesn't appear there. Then the piece for the positivity of the conditional Lhov-Sobolev constant can be proven more or less easily. So what we prove is that it's lower bounded. This conditional Lhov-Sobolev constant is lower bounded by 1/2. And then this geometric recursive argument, in this case, is not a recursive argument per se, because it's quite easy to derive it. So it's just these 5 lines. And it's because of the definition of each one of the quantities. And essentially, what we get in the end is that the global Lhov-Sobolev constant can be lower bounded by 1/2. So in this case, you see that this strategy holds, but I mean, it's kind of an easy situation. So it's you don't need so much to prove this result in this case. You don't need so big a strategy, let's say.
So first you have to prove that it's positive locally, and then you extrapolate.
Yeah, exactly. That's the idea, more or less, yes. I mean, when I write here the order of the pieces, or I'm saying that the order of the pieces goes in this direction, is not completely true, because you have to play with all of them at the same time. But yes, the idea is essentially that. The idea is that you want to write the global Lhov-Sobolev constant, you want to reduce it to a conditional Lhov-Sobolev constant in a small size, and you want to prove that it's positive. And of course, you can go now to settings that are not so trivial, that are a bit more difficult, so where you really need this kind of a strategy. So the second example is, again, the same dynamics. But now we are not assuming that the Gibbs state at the fixed point is a tensor product everywhere. So it's much more difficult. And the things that we get only hold in 1D. So now, again, we are defining the conditional Lhov-Sobolev constant for every subset or for every subregion A in the same way as the quotient between this derivative of the relative entropy, where the generator now is also defined only in A. And the thing that appears in the denominator is the conditional relative entropy in A, which is the same conditional relative entropy that I mentioned before. And now the part that is more complicated is the clustering conditions that you're assuming, or the decay of correlations that you're assuming on the Gibbs state. So now you have to assume a couple of things. One of them is that the H that I was writing before, which is how far sigma is from being a tensor product in this sense, is upper bounded by 1/2. And the problem is that now, before, if you remember, the A and B, well, before I was writing A and C, but they were connected regions. They were one A here and one B here, or C or whatever. They were separated, but they were connected. Here, we are considering unions of small subregions. So these are not connected. And in principle, this means that this expression is much more difficult to bound. So we know, for example, that this assumption is satisfied by classical Gibbs states, but we don't. We also have some other example which is a bit weird, but we don't have so many examples for this assumption to hold. Sorry.
Well, if C is extremely small, it is still true.
That's the point. Usually, you have to play with C. You have to make C big enough so that this holds.
In the assumption, do you assume it's only true for C, big enough, or it's true for every C?
No. This has to be, I mean, you have to play with C. Yeah, this doesn't, I mean, I'm not saying here that this is for every C. But you can write it explicitly, but no, this is not for every C.
True, for large enough.
It's for large enough C. Because in principle, what you're going to write, what you're going to obtain here is an exponential decay with the distance between A and B. So yes, so that you get that is smaller than 1/2, you need to take C big enough so that the A and B are separated enough so that this is smaller than 1/2. Yes, so this is not for every C. Thanks. And after this, you have to further assume something that is even more complicated, I would say. So in this case, you need to assume that this inequality holds. And if you see it and compare it to the results of quasi-factorization that I was mentioning before, this is some kind of strong quasi-factorization. So it's more or less the same, but the only difference is that here you have a conditional relative entropy instead of a relative entropy. So what you have is the fact that if you consider B as the union of two subregions, B1 and B2, you should be able to split the conditional relative entropy in B in terms of the conditional relative entropy in B1 and B2. And the multiplicative error term, the good thing that you have here is that it can be as big as you want, but the only problem is that it shouldn't depend with the size of, it shouldn't depend on the size of lambda. And this is the difficult part. So for example, we know that this holds for tensor products, as I was mentioning before, but we don't have many non-trivial examples for this. And well, considering these two assumptions and considering one nice geometry that I will briefly mention now, we can prove also that you have a positive Log-Sobolev constant. And again, for the quasi-factorization, what you do is consider this nice geometry, which is split your chain in subsets A1, B1, A2, B2, and so on, so that they overlap, but the boundaries of the subregions don't overlap. You need it explicitly because you're going to use some properties of quantum Markov chains for which you need these to hold. And then you consider A as the union of all the AIs and B as the union of all the BIs. And when you do it, you can prove some quasi-factorization in two steps. So the first one of them is that you can upper bound the relative entropy in terms of the conditional relative entropy in A and B. And then each one of them can be upper bounded, can be separated in the conditional relative entropies in all the AIs and all the BIs using this quantum Markov chain property that I was saying before. And then you use some geometric recursive argument to reduce the global Log-Sobolev constant to all these conditional Log-Sobolev constants in the AIs and BIs. And then you, using strongly this assumption too that I was mentioning before, you can prove that this is positive. So this is what we did for the Hilbert dynamics. For the Davis dynamics, we did something similar. And the Davis dynamics is another way to model some coupling of a small system with a large heat bath. But the problem that it has with respect to the Hilbert dynamics is that it doesn't have a nice explicit expression. But on the other side, you can obtain some conditional expectation by projecting onto the set of fixed points of the evolutions for every subregion A. I won't go into detail here. I will just mention that the conditional Log-Sobolev constant you have to define is a bit different now, so it has to be defined from some conditional expectation. So this is why it changes a bit. And also the conditions of decay of correlations are more related to some other results that are known for spectral gaps, but maybe more difficult to phrase in some sense, are a bit more abstract. And the most important thing, I would say, is that here, the quasi-factorization that you get is some strong quasi-factorization. As I was saying before, it's an upper bound that you can get for a conditional relative entropy already in the left-hand side and conditional relative entropies in the right-hand side. So what this implies is essentially that the result that you get it for every dimension instead of only 1D, because the geometry that you use here is easier than the one that you were using for the 1D. Yeah, I won't go into detail there, but just to mention the differences between the two settings. And this is more or less what I wanted to talk about. So, well, there are many open problems that you can stress from here. I will just mention these three because I think they are interesting. So one of them is, for example, if you can use any of the results of quasi-factorization to prove Log-Sobolev constants in a more general setting, not just for the conditions that we are imposing here. And in particular, if the heat bath examples, if you could somehow extend it for to more general dimensions. So we have some ideas, but for this, we would have to prove a quasi-factorization of this kind for the other definition of conditional relative entropy. And this is something that we haven't managed to do for a while. And of course, maybe we are not getting the desired results because we don't have the right definition of conditional relative entropy. So maybe there is a better definition of conditional relative entropy, I don't know. And the, of course, there are many other open problems, but this is, these are the ones that I think are most, the most interesting ones. So this is what I wanted to talk about, and thank you very much for your attention. If you have questions, please tell me.
So this, so you showed this, this, I guess you call it the quasi-factorization of the relative entropy, which is like a general statement of quantum states.
Yes.
And I guess this looked a lot like one of these like Fossier-Renner type results. You know, like this,
yes.
How is it related, or like the, which one inform the other in some way? Or?
No, I would like that, but and they would like that too. But no, the problem is that they usually, when they, so for example, if you go to this, let's go to the usual quasi-factorization. So if you go to this expression, for example, you have there the sum of two terms, the sum of two conditional relative entropies, and it's important that you have two. It's important that you don't have one or you don't have three, because the point is that there are facts, there are parts that are going to compensate, and that you're going to sum and cancel and these kind of things. And it seems a bit obvious what I'm saying, but when they consider, I mean, they, for example, the lower bounds that they provide, the Fossier-Renner paper and so on, is for each one of the of these quantities separated. So they consider something that they don't call conditional relative entropy, they call in a different way.
Be the product between A and B, C.
Exactly, here you're using strongly the fact that the two things that appear here like the they appear with the minus sign, so the minus d of rho c and sigma c, and the minus d of rho a sigma a, you're going to be able to write them as tensor products, and you're going to use them to do funny stuff. And for this, you need to have two. And they are only considering one difference between a global relative entropy and a conditional relative entropy, and they are providing upper bounds for, like stability results for the data processing inequality for this quantity, but only for one of them. So yes, in both directions. I mean, we would be interested on the results, and they would be interested on a results to be translated, but it's not direct to do that.
So you said that the positivity of this Lotsov-Lyapunov constant is related to the existence of a certain spectral gap.
Yes.
Which Hamiltonian? What's the?
Ah, no, the spectral gap that I'm talking about here is a spectral gap associated to the Lindbladian, so to the dissipative evolution. It's a different spectral gap.
Okay.
I mean, when it's a different definition. It's essentially the same definition that I wrote here for the conditional. Sorry, for the Lotsov-Lyapunov constant. So here, what you have is the quotient between the derivative of the relative entropy and the relative entropy, and the spectral gap in that case is the derivative of the variance over the variance. So it's a different thing. Yeah. Yeah, and what I was saying is exactly that, that if you have a conditional, sorry, if you have a positive Lotsov-Lyapunov constant, this implies that you have a positive gap in that case.
Okay, thank you.